Well, hello there, ladies and gentlemen, and good evening. The MSS crew is back and welcoming you to the Fred Bertelsen Memorial Old Time Radio Room of RadioOutOfThePast.org. The day's date is Saturday, March 19th, 2016, and this is your MSS host, Luis Jr., assisting with bringing to you yet another exciting and exhilarating internet broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. Well, folks, guess what? Just two more days until we can finally say kiss off to winter and welcome to spring. Let's get things rolling here by allowing me to introduce the presenter for tonight's program. He just so happens to be Mad Max Crawford. If everyone could just please sit back, grab your favorite drinks and snacks, and enjoy the program. Maxwell, the microphone is yours.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Maxwell, here to welcome you to Michael's Saturday Surprise for Saturday, March 19th. Let's begin our first program, Adventure is Your Heritage. And the name of the show is The Invisible Century.
This is George O'Brien bringing you the story of an invisible fence that stretches from the Earth to the Moon. Another in the series...
Adventure is Your Heritage. The story you're about to hear deals with the discovery of radar, another of the great scientific contributions of the United States Navy. Hoyt Taylor in The Invisible Century, a true story which proves that in the Navy, adventure is your heritage.
It all started, as a matter of fact, it started with a broken shoelace. On the right shoe, if I remember correctly. It was the morning of September 27th, 1922 in Washington. Leo Young and I, I'm Doc Taylor. We were experimenting with a very newfangled apparatus called shortwave radio, sending signals across the Potomac River from our spot in the Naval Aircraft Radio Laboratory near the Navy Air Station at Anacostia, Maryland.
Look out, Dr. Taylor.
Mm-hmm. You're falling all over everything today.
Darn shoelace, it's broken.
Don't you think the Navy pays you enough so you can afford a nickel for some new shoestring?
Well, I suppose so. I'll take care of it at lunch. Remind me, will you?
Yeah, I'll remind you. You know, I never believed in absent-minded scientists before, but now I really...
What's the matter?
Oh, you must have bumped into the set when you tripped.
Signal does sound different.
Yeah. Well, I took this thing apart. Now I suppose I'll have to do it all over again.
I wonder what's wrong with it.
You gave it a shove, that's what's wrong.
Signal's okay now. Listen.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Huh, yeah, that's funny.
Well, at least you can't blame me. I'll be darned.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
Maybe they're not putting out a consistent signal across the river.
You know, I think I'm going to take a few years off until they get this device perfected.
I have a hunch the Navy would like us to take a few years on and perfect it. The other sound.
Well, take a look.
Oh, it's just a boat moving up the river. Yeah, it's almost past us.
Is it past now?
Yeah.
Are there any other boats on the river?
Well, no, I don't... Oh, yeah. One is coming around the bend, heading toward us.
Good. Keep your eye on it. I'll try and tell you when it's even with us.
What? What are you talking about?
I don't know for sure. Now it's going past us.
Well, how can you tell?
I can hear it.
You can what?
Don't you see, Leo? That's what's been wrong with the signal.
Wait a minute. You mean the boats on the river are...
Distorted it, exactly.
Wait a minute, I want to turn this off.
Okay.
Well, I guess we better do our experimenting where there isn't any river traffic.
No, Leo, we'd better stay right here.
What?
What would you say if I told you I just thought of an invention that would give man new eyes? Eyes that could see through darkness, through rain, through fog.
Doc, I'd say you were crazy.
Would you?
Mm-hmm. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You mean the distortion of that signal? If a passing ship can affect a radio... Hey, Doc, I'm crazy, too.
I think we found something this afternoon, Leo. Something big. The very next day, we began to explore this unknown continent. Our experiments proved that passing objects reflect ultra-short radio waves as a mirror throws back a beam of light. These radio echoes, or wave reflections, formed the basis of the first practical system of radio detection, a system explained in a memorandum Leo and I wrote to the Navy Department.
Taylor, are you prepared to defend this thesis?
Yes, Admiral Robinson, I am.
I see. And are you aware, Dr. Taylor, that you and your co-workers were employed to perfect the ultra-shortwave radio, not to experiment on crackpot secret waves
Radio detection devices?
Precisely.
I am aware of that, sir. But I felt that the value of this discovery might be of even greater use.
Well, interestingly enough, Taylor, so do I. And so does the Navy. The department is establishing a naval research laboratory here in Washington. I'm authorized to offer you the job of superintendent of the radio division with full opportunity to continue your experiments.
Admiral, when do we start? Laboratory, Leo and I, along with many other scientists, push back still further the frontiers of radio detection. By beaming radio pulses against the ionospheric layer that blankets the Earth's surface, we learn how to measure the presence of objects by their distance and size. We sharpen the vision of our invisible eyes, but our time was growing short. In Italy, a new Caesar shouted of Mare Nostrum. Berlin street gangs, led by an ex-corporal, were breaking the windows of certain selected stores. And the sons of heaven swarmed over the Great Wall of China. Theoretical experiments gave way to practical military preparations.
It is requested that the Naval Research Laboratory undertake the discovery of methods for detection of naval aircraft.
The Navy Department wants to be informed of any theories or improvements in the field of submarine warfare.
A new landing system for aircraft. Detection of airplanes.
Submarine warfare.
Landing system. Submarine warfare.
Detection of aircraft.
What do they want from us, Leo? Miracles?
Sometimes I think so.
Submarines, airplanes. I understood we were supposed to be radio experts.
Well, we did discover the principle of radio detection.
But are we any further along now than we were 17 years ago on the day we made the discovery?
Well, we found a lot of wrong answers, but they may be the path to the right one. So we must be further along. Although I will admit that you're still going around with broken shoelaces.
Hmm? No, it was all right this morning.
Well, at least we can do something about that.
Where are you going?
Out to buy you some shoestrings. I'll be right...
What is it, Leo?
I was just thinking, Doc, that morning on the river, Maybe we really discovered everything then.
And didn't know it?
Sure. Oh, Doc, what fools we've been. Look, aircraft detection, submarine detection, just what the Navy's been asking for. Look, you remember when we were working on aircraft landing? We found that planes reflected our radio waves, the same way boats did on the Potomac.
And you think that's the answer to aircraft detection?
Well, look, if we use pulses like you did to measure the atmosphere, that's practical. Why, we'll be able to discover planes miles before you can hear them and see them. And the same thing will hold true of submarines.
Doc, we've got it! We've got it!
Radio detection and ranging. Leo, I feel like dancing!
You better not, Doc. You'll trip on your shoelaces.
Let's take a break right here. I'll have more of Adventure is Your Heritage in a moment. back to Adventure is Your Heritage.
An answer. Radio detection and ranging, eyes to search out enemy destroyers and airplanes, and with technical variations, even submarines. Then, in the maneuvers of 1938, we put our equipment aboard the USS New York, along with an operating crew headed by one of our most able assistants, a young scientist named Robert Page. We crossed our fingers, held our breaths, and waited.
Well, Mr. Page, somewhere out in that darkness is a destroyer squadron. Sometime between now and midnight, they'll attack the New York. All you have to do with that paraphernalia of yours is tell us when they're coming and where they are, if you can.
You sound dubious, Admiral Johnson.
Frankly, young man, I am. It's 11:15, Mr. Page. With your permission, Mr. Page, I'll send a lookout to the crow's nest. I do not propose to lose my ship even in a mock war while I wait for your, gadget to buzz.
Wait a minute, sir. There they are.
Where are they, Mr. Page?
Let me see. They bear one, two, true. About 8 miles away, sir. What's that, sir?
Destroyer squadron establishing its position. 8 miles away, two troop. Mr. Page, I wish you'd do me a favor.
Yes, sir?
When you go ashore, I'd like you to leave that gadget aboard. From now on, I want to have radio detection and ranging equipment as a permanent fixture of the USS New York.
Discovery won its place on the seas. We passed the first test, but an even greater one was coming. One that began on December 7th, 1941, and that nearly a year later gave final proof of the efficiency of radio detection and ranging. On the night of November 14th, 1942, the sea battle for Guadalcanal was still in doubt. The Japanese fleet had disappeared into the darkness. And then, on one of our battleships, the beep of the radio pulse told that the eyes of our invisible sentry had found the enemy over 7 miles away, hidden, waiting. The great ship lifted her gun muzzles to the stars. They flashed and thundered by salvo. Salvo landed squarely on the target. The power of the enemy fleet was broken. Our position in the Solomons was secure. We were on the sea lane to victory. And part of the glory belonged to a device that began with a broken shoelace. Radio detection and ranging, which, by now, Navy slang has shortened down to the one word, radar. This is George O'Brien again. It gives me great pleasure to introduce the real hero of our story, Dr. A. Hoyt Taylor, speaking from Claremont, California.
Thank you. I'm afraid you exaggerate the part I played in the development of an instrument which had the support and constant assistance of the finest men in the United States Navy. In particular, I want to mention the enthusiastic support given the development of radar by Admiral Johnson, following the tests aboard the USS New York. But it is a great satisfaction to know that this weapon, radar, has reached through the space to touch the moon, has proved a safety device that has already saved countless civilian lives, and today serves as an ever-constant protective fence around the boundaries of this nation.
Thank you, Dr. Taylor. By Bob Libet and Frank Burt, and was directed by Frank K. Danzig for Universal Recorder. George O'Brien of appeared by arrangement with the Hollywood Coordinating Committee. This program is transcribed under the general supervision of William J. Bailey for the United States Navy Recruiting Service. And now this is Don Wilson inviting you to join us soon again for another in the series, Adventure is Your Heritage.
Well, folks, that was Adventure is Your Heritage and the Invisible Century. And now, time for 2000 Plus and When the Worlds Met, as aired on May the 3rd, 1950.
Imaginations forward into time, into the years beyond 2000 AD. What strange adventures, what exciting things will we find in the world of tomorrow? 2000 Plus. Today, an adventure of outer space, when the worlds met. Year 2000 plus 20. At the giant spaceport in Washington, D.C., temporary capital of the Federated World Government, an enormous throng, tense with expectancy, jams every available inch of space surrounding the rocket landing field. All eyes strain upward into the clear blue sky. For today is the day, April 21st, 2000 plus 20. And audio and televox networks of the world are at the rocket field to cover the epic event. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is the day we've all been waiting for. In a matter of minutes now, out of that brilliant blue sky will come a ship, a spaceship, carrying in its gleaming hold the first load of uranium taken from the pits of Luna, satellite of Earth. Since the beginning of time... Now, one moment, folks. There's a signal from the tower. This may be it. Take it away, Fred.
This is Fred Haskins reporting from the control tower. Our escort planes have been in contact with the spaceship from Luna for the past 12 minutes. They are now approaching the field from the northeast, and any moment now we can expect...
And there she is! The rocket has blown up! 70 hours out of Luna City! Her magnesium hull white hot from the friction of the atmosphere. Her jet brakes belching fire. She's right over the field now! She's coming down! 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 Mark well this date, my friends. This is the dawn of the interplanetary age.
Earth calling Moon. Earth calling Moon. I'm in Luna City.
Luna City, Johnny Dixon.
Dixon, where you been? You're 3 minutes late.
Sorry, McCabe. All shipments as scheduled. Everything routine.
Report noted. Check out.
Check it.
You know, Johnny...
What, Paul?
Sometimes I think we're crazy. Spending our lives cooped up in this pressurized shell, breathing synthetic air, risking our necks every time we put on a spacesuit and go out into the cold, barren, pitted piece of green cheese. And for what?
Well, you're kidding, Paul. You know the answer. We're space happy. That's all that's wrong with us. Huh. We pulled every wire and practically tore the World Federation apart getting this assignment on the moon. And we'll do it again when the first flight into deep space gets underway. Next month, next year, whenever they get through with their preparations.
Yeah, I guess that's it. And right now, Johnny, what I wouldn't give to see a tree again. And corn fields in Kansas.
Me, I want to hear a bird sing. And watch the lights go on in the skyscrapers along the waterfront. I want to dance with my girl and breathe in the sweet smell of lilac. Boy, if I... What was that?
Huh?
That sound, that vibration. There, do you hear it?
Well, I'm not sure whether I heard or felt it, Johnny. Like a current of air passing by me.
Yeah, that's it. Some kind of pulsation. Makes my skin tingle.
Listen.
sounded different, didn't it?
Yeah, a different pitch.
The instruments are all steady. Nothing on the visit screen. The radar's negative.
What is it, Johnny?
Where's it from?
It's not from Earth, I'll swear to that.
I got a crazy notion, Paul.
A crazy notion that someone's trying to signal us.
You mean...
I don't know what I mean. Maybe McCain's right. Maybe I got a touch of...
Johnny, what is it?
Look, Paul. Look at the direction finder. It's swung all the way around. Those sounds, those waves are coming from outer space. I've got to call...
Earth calling Luna City. Earth calling Luna City.
Luna City to Earth. Go ahead, Earth. Go ahead, McCain.
Dixon, what's going on up there? What's the idea of beaming out those hammy signals?
Signals?
Yeah, the harpy effect. The music of the sphere stuff. Giving the boys in the monitors down here the heebie-jeebies.
You got them too, McCabe? You picked them up on Earth?
Certainly. What's it all about?
The signals, if that's what they are coming from one definite spot in outer space.
Outer space?
That's what I said.
Johnny, get your space suit ready. Better have a conference about it.
But listen...
Have your men tune up rocket 307. Blast off at 0800. We'll be expecting you on Earth in the morning.
Now we've been getting those signals, and not one of you geniuses has been able to decipher them.
Hey, well, Mr. McCabe, if you know of anyone who can do it better, then
take
it
easy, Professor Wolfson. You don't have to be so touchy. But 10 days. What do you say, Dr. Lee?
10 days or 10 years, it makes no difference. If those sounds or signals are code, it is in a language unknown to man.
You're sure of that?
We've consulted the foremost cryptographists of the world. We've tried every way to break the code.
What does that add up to?
That message, if it is a message, does not come from anywhere on Earth or from any man on Earth.
I told you, Chief. It's what I've been saying all along. Of course you can't decode those messages in any known language, living or dead, because they come from Mars.
Mars, I cannot possibly...
Yes, Mars. My directional finder on the moon indicated it, and McCabe's down here pinned it down. Look at the graph. I brought it.
Directional signals can be wrong.
Yes, sir, but get this. I've been timing those signals. They come at intervals of exactly 24 hours, 37 minutes, and 22 seconds.
The length of the day on Mars.
Yeah. And if we were trying to signal them, we'd do it, say, every night at 1800. That's what they're doing to us.
In that case, the next signal is due
at... 10 minutes and 13 seconds. And we'll be sitting here like lummoxes, feeling our scalps tingle while the message drifts past us.
Gentlemen, excuse, please. But it seems to me the message need not necessarily drift past us.
I know what you mean.
By the message, I do not mean the sounds... or the words that are being transmitted. I refer to the thoughts themselves. The thoughts that perhaps are being transferred from the Martians to us.
Thought transference? That's telepathy.
We have discarded that word, Mr. Dixon. Too many charlatans used it. But we do know that there is extrasensory perception of thought impulses. Just as there are sound waves which your ear has learned to interpret... and light waves which your eye and brain transform into a picture. So there are thought waves, electrical impulses discharged by the brain, which vary with the particular thought.
An intriguing idea, Dr. Lee. If only we had some instrument that could pick up and sort out these impulses.
There is such an instrument, Professor Wilson.
What?
I have been working on it for many years. It involves a scanning screen intercepting an electrified field.
Well, what are we waiting for?
You understand, the telepathetor has only been tested for short distances.
The signals are reaching us. That's the only important thing, isn't it?
How soon can we... The instrument is in the next room. I took the liberty of bringing it with me, hoping it might conceivably be of some use. This way, gentlemen.
You say this little machine can take thoughts and turn them into words we can hear? English words?
Not only English, Mr. McKeep. It will translate thought impulses into any language for which you set the dials. You think of something, Mr. Dixon. Now, listen. First, I set for French.
Et maintenant, les Chinois.
German.
Wonderful, these Chinesen.
And English.
Darn clever, these Chinese.
You must understand...
Oh, excuse me, Dr. Lee, but we'll have to postpone this. 15 seconds to go. Better set your dials for remote pickup. Stand by, everyone.
Nothing. More power.
Well, it was a good try.
Wait. I've got that feeling again. My skin's beginning to crawl.
Yeah, mine too. Oh, no, it's just your imagination.
Quiet! They are coming through now.
Planet 4, greeting planet 3.
This is Mars.
The fourth planet from the sun. Greeting planet 3. Planet 4 calling planet 3. We are trying to reach you, planet 3. If you receive our signal, respond. If you receive our signal, respond. We will communicate again.
Life on Mars. This week, ladies and gentlemen, the question that has bedeviled mankind ever since the day he first stood erect and gazed into the heavens has been answered. There is life on Mars, intelligent, articulate life. The country, the world, tonight seethes with excitement. Has Mars received our response? Has our telepathator succeeded in projecting, as thoughts, the messages spoken into it by human beings? Or can it merely receive...
I'll never get enough of it.
Oh, it's lovely, Johnny. And look, there's a moon out tonight.
Moon? Oh, please. You know, it's hard to believe that back in 1950, people could still get romantic over that cold, dead, pockmarked, heavenly yo-yo. Now, that red star up there, Mars, that's a different proposition. It's alive. There are living beings up there.
Johnny, it's staggering. It's beyond imagination. It's
rubbish. Why shouldn't there be life up there?
They're so advanced. Spaceships and interplanetary signals.
Maybe you've got a point at that. We thought we were so smart because we reached the moon. Our spaceships aren't developed enough yet to get to Mars.
It's just as well.
What?
Because you'd want to be the first to go.
Wouldn't you like that? I'd be quite a hero. You could point at my picture and say, hey, that's my guy.
You're my guy anyway, Johnny.
Sure, Terry. But don't worry, honey. I won't be seeing any Martians for a long time.
All personnel, stand by. Stand by for XM signal.
That'll be Mars. Hop to it, Johnny.
Telepathator setting 212 degrees, 18 seconds. Frequency 600,000.
Got that, Johnny?
Check.
Planet 4 calling Planet 3. Planet 4 calling Planet 3. We greet you in peace. Your response received.
We got through it all.
The time has come. At this moment, which marks the beginning of the great interstellar age between worlds, it is fitting that there be between us a meeting of minds. Therefore, we are sending a ship to visit your planet.
No, it can't be.
The ship will depart tonight and enter your magnetic field in 7 of our days. Have landing instructions ready. We come in peace. We come in peace.
Gentlemen, this is Matt Wilson bringing you a report of the emergency session of the Federated World Government. Never has an assembly meeting taken place in such an atmosphere of excitement, panic, and recrimination. And here on the floor of the assembly chamber,
we've been up
all the emotions aroused by the stunning message from Mars have been boiling and clashing all day.
I rise for a point of information. As civilian head of the world military government, I want to know why those Martians have beaten us to the draw.
Gentlemen, if the decision we are to make is to be a wise one, we must lay aside passions and fears and consider the question calmly. The Martians are coming, and we must receive them either with friendship or hostility.
Drive them off! Blast them out of the sky!
But that may not be as simple as it sounds. Remember, my friend, these Martians are advanced scientifically, perhaps far beyond us. They have conquered deep space. They can transmit thought waves. They may have weapons beside which our nuclear bombs are as toy pistols.
Dr. Lee is right, gentlemen. We don't dare fight them off. The risk is too great.
They come in peace. They said so over and over again. Let us so receive them.
Very well, very well. If such is the will of this body, let them come in peace. But as civilian head of the world military government, I assure you all, we will not be found napping.
Earth calling Martian interstellar ship. Earth calling Martian interstellar ship. Here are the landing instructions of the Federated World Government. 3 Earth days from this hour, which will be the 6th Martian day of your flight through space, you will be met by an escort of 20 rocket ships. We will greet you in the name of peace. The 20 rocket ships will escort you.
Instructions to Commission of Defense. All escort rocket ships assigned to accompany Martian spaceship will carry the following armaments: death fog sprays, magnetic disintegrators, atomic missiles class B. All weapons shall be on the...
And upon your entry into the Earth's atmosphere, you will circle our globe once and then make landing at our spaceport at Los Alamos, New Mexico, which will be ready to receive you.
The spaceport of Los Alamos shall be mined to a depth of 50 feet with tritonium landmines. The field shall be encircled with radioactive flamethrowers and a reserve force.
From the landing field, you will be conducted to the seat of the world government at Washington, D.C., where you will be received and housed in suitable accommodations. We will welcome you in peace. Check out.
We will welcome you in peace. We hope.
Suitable accommodations. Trust McCabe to hand me a crackpot assignment like this.
Oh, Johnny, you're the big space man. You're supposed to know by instinct what's suitable accommodation for a Martian.
Don't be silly, Terry. I haven't the slightest notion in the world what they look like except some crazy ideas I picked up from science fiction. I don't know why.
All right. That's why we're here. The head of our anthropology section has more ideas than any science fiction writer you've ever read. Now, here we are.
Ah, Terry, come in.
Hello, Professor. This is Mr. Dixon, the young man I told you about.
I know Mr. Dixon.
Professor, I've got a problem.
Terry and I have discussed the problem. It is my theory that the Martians will, in most important respects, have the characteristics of the Earthman.
Oh, what's the basis of your theory, Professor?
It's very simple. The accomplishments of the Martians parallel our own. Only a being with opposable thumbs can fashion the intricate devices necessary for spaceships. Only a being with a nervous system like our own could master communication. Only a creature with a brain like ours could dream of peace.
Makes sense, Professor.
That's one side of it, Johnny. A lot of other anthropologists think differently.
Yeah, that is so.
They feel that the Martians living on a dry planet with little vegetation and very little water will be creatures that crawl on the ground like our insects, enlarged a few thousand times. They may look like enormous ants with oversized antennae.
I give up. With 48 hours left, I can't prepare accommodations for every conceivable form of life. I'll just have to improvise after they get here. I just hope they don't get too sick when they first look at us.
Matt Wilson again, reporting from the spaceport at Los Alamos. A tremendous crowd is gathered here. We're awaiting the appearance of the spaceship from Mars, which is being escorted by 20 rocket ships from the rendezvous near the moon. According to reports, all's gone well so far. The Martian ship... one moment, please. The naughty box announcement is going to be made to the people assembled.
Your attention, please. The ship from Mars and its escorts will be seen any moment from the east.
You heard that. Any moment, the ship from Mars and... Wait, there they are! And now,
Martian ship is idling over the field now, casting a huge shadow over the landscape. It's an awe-inspiring spectacle. The ship is tremendous, 18 to 20 stories in height, several city blocks long, and its large windows are fashioned of some kind of transparent...
Civilian commander to Special Defense Patrol. Man battle stations.
Our technical experts are staring at the craft in open-mouthed wonder. Mr. McCabe, what is your reaction?
I am dumbfounded. The ship doesn't seem to operate on a rocket principle. There's no belching fire, no clouds of smoke. I keep wondering what kind of fuel they use, what principles of propulsion, what metal.
Thank you, sir. The ship is almost touching the ground now, and the crowd is getting uneasy. Why, they're falling back, as though there was something. I see it now. Why, it's a blue haze drifting about the Martian ship, forming a 20-foot blanket of whatever it is.
Command and defense patrol, 0 hour. Reorient all weapons. Remove safety controls. Stand by to fire.
The Secretary of the World Federation is going to speak.
As your great ship settles on our soil, we salute you, the emissaries of space. We wait eagerly for your appearance.
Now, the blue mist has completely vanished. All eyes are on the ship, waiting for the first Martian to appear. There is no sign of activity yet.
Will you respond to our greetings, Martians? Will you make your presence known?
Nothing stirring. No gangplank lowered. No sign of life. Perhaps they were not prepared for atmospheric conditions here. Perhaps on the very brink of success, death has struck within that awe-inspiring vessel. Wait, it looks... Yes, it's moving. A tremendous section of the ship's prow is opening out in front. Like a gigantic tongue, it thrusts forward and drops to earth, forming a great ramp from the ship to our soil. And now it's down, and the surface of the ramp is like nothing ever seen on this earth. A shimmering, impalpable iridescence, unbelievably radiant and beautiful. The throng of spectators is silent, motionless, scarcely breathing, waiting to see the first Martian emerge. And still, nothing. No one, no thing comes down the ramp. There is nothing but silence. Listen, that must be the Martian communication vibrations we were told about. Then men on the field are operating the receiving device.
Earthmen, we ask that you send one representative to board our craft. We assure his safety.
What? Gentlemen, there is no cause for alarm.
I think there is. They want a hostage or a specimen to take back with them.
There's no time for anything. They're waiting for a decision.
Mr. Secretary.
Yes, Mr. McCabe.
If it's all right with the committee, I'd like to go aboard. Technical information, sir.
No.
Quiet, Charlie.
This is my dish, McCabe. I was slated for the space run to Mars, remember? They're not doing me out of this. Besides, you're too valuable to waste. Mr. Secretary, tell them I'm coming aboard.
Men of Mars, we comply with your request. Our representative is about to board your ship.
Get ready, Johnny Dixon. This is it. Take a good long look at the sun and the sky. Take a deep breath of the Earth's good air. You may never get another after you meet whatever is waiting at the end of this long ramp. The ramp. Pulling me forward like a conveyor belt. It's beginning to rise into the air. Get a move on, Johnny. Get into that ship. Get into that ship. Get made it. Locked in. Now what? There's no one here. Nothing except that dancing light. I'll follow it.
Afraid.
know my name?
We know many things. That is why we are sad, filled with revulsion.
I don't understand. What do you mean?
Through the dark spaceways, we came to you in peace. You said to us, come in peace. But the escorts you sent to honor us were armed for destruction. The very ground on which we now rest seethes with radioactive potential.
Wait! You've misunderstood us. These weapons are for defense against you, not attack.
Many cycles ago, we of Mars learned, as you Earthmen will someday learn, that wars are fought, men are slaughtered, civilizations wiped out by those who attack with weapons of defense.
But our world is at peace now.
Your peace is not peace. It is a thin cloak which covers the hates and fears and savagery of primitive beings. Observe, Dixon. On this large visit screen, we have for hours been viewing your people in many parts of your Earth. Watch.
The Senator.
Listen.
I warned you it was a trap. We'll never again see Dixon alive. I told you not to trust foreigners. Just give me the word and I'll blast them all into kingdom come.
You must not be deceived. He's only one man. The rest of us are different.
Are you? Look at this from another part of your civilized Earth.
You have been a traitor to our party. You've been guilty of bourgeois thinking. You have sold us out to the enemies of our people.
You will pay the penalty. But first you will confess. Confess? Confess!
That's a backward part of our planet. It's not fair to judge by them.
Then we reveal a more civilized area. The country of your birth, Dixon.
No, no, no!
Hello, Miguel! Kyle, too good for him! Hang him, I say, hang him! The rope! String him up in the highest tree in the square! Lynch him! Lynch him! Lynch him!
Now you know why we shall not reveal ourselves to you. If you are like this to these of your own kind, what will you think? What will you do when you see us, strange as we are?
Don't go. We know you may be different from us, but we can all meet in peace.
Earthman, peace must be achieved through toil and sacrifice of those few among you who understand its meaning. It may take many cycles, but in the end, the day will arrive. Then, and then only, we will return. Go back to your people, man of Earth, and give them the message from Mars.
Next week, another exciting drama on 2000 Plus, The Silent Noise. In the year 2000 Plus 20, an important man is murdered. How will the police of the future track down a killer? And what new methods of assault will the criminals of tomorrow use? Listen next week, and you'll find out. 2000 Plus is produced by Sherman H. Dreyer and Robert Winolson. In today's story, Ken Williams played Johnny, Louis Van Ruten played the voice of Mars, Lon Clark played McCabe, Frank Behrens was the Senator, Amsey Strickland was Terry, Sanford Bickert was Paul, and Gilbert Mack was Dr. Lee. The orchestra was conducted by Emerson Buckley, music composed by Elliot Jacoby. Script by Judith and David Bublik. Sound by Walt Shaver and Al April. Engineer Bob Albrecht, and your announcer, Ken Marvin. This program was transcribed. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Well, folks, that was 2000 Plus, and When the Worlds Met, as aired on May the 3rd, 1950. And now, let's hear Face to the Future.
In the country of Elam, the highland near Persia, historians noted the first appearance of the potter's wheel and the cartwheel. Since the Elamites were nomads and lived in rough country, the wheel may have evolved from putting logs under primitive sleds so they would roll easier than they could be dragged.
This statement came from the notes of a French archaeologist who found evidence of human remains not far from the Persian Gulf, dating 20,000 years before Christ.
This is Face to the Future, a new transcribed series on this station produced in cooperation with the North American Air Defense Command. Its conductor is Del Vina, well-known broadcaster, author, lecturer, a lady of adventure as well. It's Face to the Future. And here is our hostess, Del Vina.
Welcome again to Face to the Future. The famous sportscaster of yesteryear, Ted Husing, was one of the handiest men of all time with the spoken word. In machine gun style, exactly appropriate words poured from him in tense broadcasting situations of all kinds. He got this fluency by reading the dictionary, picking words, writing them down three times, and repeating their meaning. Once he had done this, he became remarkable among men because of his ability to store these words and meanings, then bring them up at just the right moment when they were needed. For this, he became an unparalleled phenomena in the first half of this century. The phenomena of the second half of that same century will probably be the computer, machines that can store, memorize, and recall so completely and quickly that human beings are only able to guide and program them, not perform competitively with them. Maybe you remember Art Linkletter's program some time ago.
Hello?
Hello, Shirley?
Yes?
This is Bob Cardell. I'm not quite sure what this is all about, but I was told to call you tonight at 8 o'clock.
Were you ever infatuated with the voice of a stranger on the telephone? That's what happened on that telephone call that we've recorded and played for you. And if you watched our last program, you saw a girl named Shirley Saunders who had written in to find a mate through our UNIVAC selection system and who had...
Yes, you're right. That was the first step after the punch card carrying the personality traits and interests of one Bob Cardell and Shirley Saunders, total strangers, were processed through a UNIVAC machine. The answer came up that they were compatible for marriage. They didn't even have to meet in a cafeteria, at a bus stop, or bump into each other in a swinging door. They had never seen each other, so Art Linkletter was ready to arrange a surprise meeting to test the infallibility of a machine in matrimonial matters.
Well, now let's go on down the audience and see if we can find your fella. Now, Shirley, here in the audience, looking out over this array of faces, we will show you several people, one of whom is your UNIVAC mate, and I want to see if you can recognize him. Now, take a look at this first man right there in the first row. Handsome young fella, isn't he?
Yes.
You recognize him at all? You don't have any feeling one way or the other?
No.
Uh-huh. Now, I'll take a look at the second young man right there. Blonde, good-looking. He might very well be. Now we'll look at the third man up the row. As a brunette. He's a big, tall, good-looking fella. Do you feel anything special toward any one of these fellas?
Oh, I feel like kissing you.
How did it turn out? Well, they are Mr. and Mrs. Bob Cardell today, happily married and have been for many, many months. What happened here dated from 22,000 years ago when man first found the principle of the wheel, and a highly sophisticated machine had successfully invaded the most basic of human relationships. To prove it, I went on a hunt for my next guest. Would you identify yourself, please?
Well, I'm Bob Cardell of the System Development Corporation in Santa Monica.
Being with System Development Corporation, which specializes in computer operations, the UNIVAC experience must have left its mark on you.
The engineers and scientists, which are approximately 3,500 at System Development, are engaged in the development of large-scale man-machine control systems. Possibly the largest of these is the SAGE system in the aerospace defense area. I'm sure that the current SAGE system, which is a factor against the manned bomber threat today, will be improved and sophisticated so all offensive and defensive military forces can be managed from a single console or switchboard, or teams of them. This will be more true of space then than it is today.
While we're used to seeing such computer operations as data processing and bookkeeping, what are some of the advanced areas you're getting into?
There are also experimental systems in use at the present time on automated teaching systems and medical diagnoses.
People are prone to talk about these things as mechanical brains or mental machines. Is this actually true?
Well, I'm afraid not. The machine in itself does nothing. It's activated by people. The information is put into the machine by people. The only function that the machine actually serves is in the systematizing, the speeding up of man's operations. It doesn't do anything but what a man could do for himself in a much longer period of time.
Is this really an extension, then, of the slide rule which helped the mathematician so much and still does?
Yes, in essence it is. The earliest form of this type of operation was the abacus.
It may take men and women to build them, men and women to run them, but the age of the machine is still in its infancy. It will change the face of the world, watch the face of the world, and provide greater leisure for all the people. Since that youngster of yours who will enter kindergarten this fall will be 45 in the year 2000, he will benefit from and use machines in ways not generally known today. Bob, what will machines or computers be doing in the year 2000?
At that time, we'd keep records from on everyone, from the cradle to the grave. These would include their medical records, all of the pertinent birth information, their employment records, educational background, whether they had run afoul of the law at any time. These would all be centrally stored in computers. At birth, each person would be assigned a code and card number. And at any subsequent time, by simply feeding this code or card number into the centralized computer, it would print out every last thing that was involved in his background. Then we go into other larger areas. Our entire defense project, what we might call an aerospace program, would be entirely automated. The stop and go button on every machine would have to be activated by a human finger.
Go in governing the conduct of man, ruling his world, making his life better or worse? Will things go so far that a little dust in his punch card for medical diagnosis will change what ails him from measles to mumps? Or if he inserts the card a little cockeyed, which will take him to Aunt Minnie's house on that future computerized transportation, is he apt to wind up at the downtown drugstore instead? Apparently not. Because the human factor, The ability to break a programmed move when error is detected will always have to be there. The old historians and biologists tell us that the greatest evolutionary breakthrough of all was man's brain. It has been man's brain which has given us a degree of machine-produced mentality, with which, even though the brain moves more slowly, it is still required as a shepherd.
This has been Face to the Future, a transcribed series on this station, produced in cooperation with the North American Air Defense Command and featuring Delvina with her parade of interesting guests. Be with us next time as we put our face to the future.
Well, folks, that was Face to the Future. And now it's time for another short program, Art Baker's Notebook.
Howdy, folks. This is Art Baker. In my notebook through the years, I've jotted down a lot of things that were interesting to me, and I sort of like to pass them along, hoping that they'll click with you. Well, let's take a look at this page of the notebook.
From the mailbag, dear Mr. Baker, in your broadcast, you asked for more nominations for your nice people department. Well, here's one story which, while old, is still new because human nature does not change. Many, many years ago, before the San Francisco fire and earthquake, my wife and I, then living in Colorado, made our first vacation trip to the Pacific coast. On the train, we made the acquaintance of a young couple with two small children, about 2 and 4 years old. We arrived in San Francisco about midnight, very tired and rather dirty. A courteous policeman escorted us to a streetcar which would take us to a hotel which had been recommended to us by a fellow passenger, and an equally courteous streetcar conductor let us off at the right corner and directed us to the hotel where we all arrived between midnight and 1 a.m., only to find all rooms and other facilities occupied, as it was then the last day of a Portola festival. The night clerk, between other duties, called up at least a dozen other hotels in an effort to accommodate us. And then one of the guests checked out, so the clerk offered us that room. Our young fellow travelers, however, with their sleepy children, who had to be carried from the depot, needed the room more than we did, so my wife and I settled back in our chairs, expecting to spend the rest of the night in the lobby. Then came the nice people act. The clerk called me to the desk and explained that the hotel was under the same management with another one, reasonably near, in which he himself had his room, which he would not need until he went off duty in the morning. Well, the room was very small and crowded, but if we wished, we could use it, and he would have a cot put in with a single bed. We gratefully accepted, as he explained that in the morning there would be plenty of rooms in both hotels. Well, the room was crowded, so crowded I had to remain outside in the hall in order to give my wife room to undress. In the morning, we were given better quarters, so our first and subsequent impressions of San Francisco have always been most kindly. I've always regretted we did not learn the name of that young man, and don't even remember the name or location of the hotels now. If you can use this letter, any part of it, please omit my name. You see, in that letter, I think, there's a beautiful illustration of an indelible impression. Here's an incident that happened, oh, half a century ago. And yet the memory, obviously, lives as clearly as if it had happened only yesterday. The policeman, the conductor, the hotel clerk, even the family with the two small children, they all fit into a picture that has not faded at all in all those years. Why? But because an act of thoughtfulness and kindness applied the fixative. There are about 18,000 nights in a 50-year period. And there's something amazing in itself when one should remain so clear and sharp while other hundreds and other thousands have faded completely away. That's a very powerful fixative, huh? In these intervening years, San Francisco has spent millions of dollars in advertising and promotion, converted islands into spectacular splendor, played host to a world exposition. But I wonder if any of them planted a picture that will be more long remembered and more cherished than this one little act of kindness by an unknown hotel clerk in the Bay City way back in those years. How many times in, say, 50 years has the writer of that letter announced to friends, San Francisco, there is a town? And how could anybody put a price tag on such an earnest testimonial?
Well, I'd be the last person in the world to question the value of advertising on the radio or television or billboards or newspaper or magazines or even skywriting. But I'm afraid there's nothing that can contribute to a city's fair name and wide respect quite like little acts of kindness by its nice people. Well, I see it's time to close the notebook for today. Say, by the way, if you think of any items that might fit into this notebook thing, send them along to me, Art Baker, Armed Forces Radio Service, Los Angeles, USA. I'd sure like to hear from you.
That was Art Baker's Notebook. And now it's time for our last show. Here is Read Out Loud. And it's called Sunrise. It was aired on October the 3rd, 1943.
This is Orson Welles, reading out loud. Now here's a poem by John Donne. I'm very fond of it. I hope you'll enjoy hearing it. It's called The Sun Rising.
Busy old fool, unruly sun, why dost thou thus through windows and through curtains call on us? Must to thy motions lover seasons run? Saucy, pedantic wretch, go chide late schoolboys and sour prentices. Go tell court huntsmen that the king will ride. Call country ants to harvest offices. Love, all alike, no season knows, nor clime, nor hours, days, months, which are the rags of time. Thy beam so reverent and strong, why shouldst thou seek? I could eclipse and cloud them with a wink, but that I would not lose her sight so long. If her eyes have not blinded thine, look. And tomorrow late, tell me whether both the Indias of spice and mine be where thou left'st them, or lie here with me. Ask for those kings whom thou saw'st yesterday, and thou shalt hear, all here in one bed lay. She is all states, and all princes I, nothing else is. Princes do but play us. Compared to this, all honors mimic, all wealth alchemy. Our son art half as happy as we, in that the world's contracted thus. Thine age asks ease, and since thy duties be to warm the world, that's done in warming us. Shine here to us, and thou art everywhere. This bed thy center is. These walls, thy sphere.
I've just read you The Sun Rising, a poem by John Donne. Lovers always think the sun shines mainly on themselves. In prose, however, the lover whose song you've just heard bravely admitted man's responsibility to man. Said John Donne, any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. Civilization begins with that opinion, and civilization ends when nobody cares or dares to express it. Evaluations of big resonant words like independence aren't easily agreed upon these days, so I submit here something written as advice to the young. The author of all people is George Jessel, the very gifted comedian who has just warmly and frankly written his autobiography. So Help Me is the title. Only those who find no diversion in the Broadway column are not expected to enjoy Mr. Jessel's account of his own doings and undoings. Assuming that most of you listening are like most people, that only some of you are regular customers at Lindy's and the Stork, I quote here but sparingly from the Jessel memoirs. My advice to you, says Mr. Jessel, Mr. Up-and-Coming, is to have the best possible time. Enjoy your cup to the brim, but always be sure you hurt nobody but yourself. You've got a right to do that if you want to. You don't belong to the state. You belong to you. I've read from the epilogue of Mr. Jessel's book because it cues a good argument. Me, I don't think I belong to me, or you belong to you. I don't even think George Jessel belongs to his mother, and not exclusively. Nobody has the right to abuse what isn't his, and the way I look at it, all members of the human family are each other's property. The state hasn't got anything to do with it. American people, that immense community of individuals, pretty much agree that the state belongs to them. No man is an island, said the author of that poem I read you. He said this from a pulpit more than 300 years ago. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. John Donne was a preacher, an ordained minister of God, but he wouldn't have disapproved of George Jessel's advice to Mr. Up-and-Coming to have the best possible time. It ought to be good for him. If it isn't good for him, Donne would have argued it isn't the best possible time. Donne, in Jessel's words, enjoyed his own cup to the brim, celebrating that enjoyment in poetry as enthusiastically sensual as the verses you heard tonight. And now, because we've just got time for it, as much as because the motion picture for whom the bell tolls gives it news interest, I'm going to read some more of the Donne sermon. Nunc lentu sonitu dicunt morieris. Now this bell, tolling softly for another, says to me, thou must die. The bell that rings to a sermon calls not upon the preacher only, but upon the congregation to come. So this bell calls us all. The bell doth toll for him that thinks it doth. And though it intermit again, yet from that minute that that occasion wrought upon him, he is united to God. Who bends not his ear to any bell which upon any occasion rings, but who can remove it from that bell which is passing a piece of himself out of this world? No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of thy friends or of thine own were. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind. And therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. It's time to say goodnight now. This is Orson Welles reading out loud. Next week, same time, same station, same thing. If you like this new kind of program, please join me. Until then, I remain, as always, beating for yours.
I hope you enjoyed today's programs. I found them interesting because some of those rare OTRR singles, doubles, collections shows are ones you won't find every day. And I enjoyed playing them, and I hope you all have a good evening. Peace out and have fun. And now, let's pass the mic to Louise.
Okay, Max, thanks a lot. Great work as usual. I hope our listening audience enjoyed that. But unfortunately, it is that time again. Max set him up. Now I'm going to have to shut it down for this week's broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. But don't worry, folks. We will be back again. You know how to find us, you know where to find us, and you know when. The spring OTR marathon is in the winds. Be on the lookout for further listings or announcements. If you have any questions, comments, or maybe even a complaint or two, maybe even a request or three, don't address them to me, but in fact, address them to the MSS director, Miguel Amaro. He can be found at mikeameli@earthlink.net. That's MIKE. AMELI @ EARTH LINK.NET. We will soon be releasing the key and returning the room to you, the listening audience. Please do with it as you wish, for as long as you wish. But just remember, be nice to one another. On behalf of myself and the rest of the MSS crew, have a great night, a great weekend. Goodbye.